open my eyes. This is a conversation with Kilio Papadopoulou, partner and inclusion and diversity officer at PwC Cyprus. Welcome, Kilio.
Hello, nice to be here.
So happy that we managed to meet
finally
after our preparatory talks.
Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. And I want to begin our talk going down the memory lane. When you went to the UK in the beginning of your career to pursue a ballet direction, and which then transitioned into accounting. Do you have some recollection of those early days and how that transition manifested in your life?
That's true. My big passion, it has always been my passion in life, is dancing. So I started dancing when I was about 9 years old. Classical dancing ballet in Cyprus. And like all little girls, my dream was to become a ballerina. Mm-hmm. But I was not just like any other little girl. I was actually very serious about it. So I trained and trained and trained to sort of go to the Royal School of Ballet in the UK to study dance. What really happened was an injury basically showed me how fragile a career of a dancer is. And the Royal School of Ballet decided I should join the Polytechnic of Central London and become an accountant. So I was a student, an excellent student in school, the 20 out of 20 student, studying hard and excelling in everything. And because I thought I couldn't go into the top ballet school, I wouldn't compromise for something less than that. So I decided to sort of, my dad actually decided that I should become an accountant. So I started a foundation in accounting. I don't even have a degree, to be honest. Mm. I don't have a university degree. I went straight into accounting and straight into professional exams. And I finished at the age of 20, became a certified chartered accountant, and then got a job in London. And then dancing became my hobby more than my job. And as I said, has always been my passion.
So these are two completely different worlds in my mind. On the one hand, we have the world of creative expression and art. And on the other hand, we have the world of numbers and laws and rules and compliance. So it's a very interesting intersection and transition. And when you basically began your professional journey at PwC, could you describe your journey from a trainee all the way to partnership? What were the key challenges, lessons, and recollections or milestones that come to mind when it comes to the trajectory from the trainee to the from the humble trainee to the highest echelons of the profession and becoming partner at PwC? What were the key challenges and lessons?
Before we get there, let me tell you the lessons I've learned from the initial stages in the UK, and possibly that's more important for people who are listening than reading my story. Mm-hmm. So the first lesson there is that you don't need a university degree to make it in life. So this is what I say to many people in PwC now, that you know, mm-hmm. think that you need to have a university degree and a master's and a doctorate in order to make it. That's not true. It's what you can actually do with your brain and your hard work that matters, not really mm-hmm. a qualification you get in university. The second message is that, with some exceptions, most of us who go and study, and the exceptions are maybe doctors and maybe architects or whatever, you study something and you sort of end up in a completely different space in life. So a lot of people who are sort of struggling as to what they need to study and whether that's what they decide to do in university is like the deal breaker for the rest of their life, that's not true. It's basically just a step towards something else you're moving to in life. And life is unexpected. I mean, the injury that hit me basically changed my plans, but there's a silver lining in everything. And looking back, I don't regret not becoming a dancer, because that's maybe it's a very creative and exciting career, but it's a very short career. By the end, age of 33 or something, your career is done, and then you need to figure out what else to do in life. So, you know, who knows what is good and what is bad in life? So whatever comes and whatever we do, there's always, you know, something that will come and sort of change our plans and do something different. And so, yeah.
Ironically, then, the injury that led you to, let's say, temporarily forfeit the ambitions for becoming a dancer was itself part of a wider choreography of that was in store for you in life.
Yeah, and that's for everybody. Any hurdle that comes across, anything that changes our plans, anything that... And I'm a person who is a control freak. I need to have a plan and I need to follow the plan. And when the plan doesn't go according to plan, then, you know, all hell block, it breaks loose. But, you know, the lessons from the... from all these is that, you know, you need to adjust your plans and, you know, nobody knows what is good for you and, you know, just see the positive side of everything that comes along. So coming back to your question, yes, I joined PwC. I left the UK in 1992 and joined PwC. I wasn't a trainee because I did my training in London. So I worked a few years in London and, and I joined PwC and I joined the PwC as a assistant manager. At the time, and 10 years and three children later, I became the first female partner in the firm. So what has helped me basically make it beyond, you know, hard work and discipline and determination is support from various people. I had mentors in the office who have actually helped me progress and actually helped me to become ambitious because I joined PwC with zero ambition. And actually, I was spending most of the first years convincing myself that I was not good enough to be made a partner. And I was from a family of civil servants who wanted me to be a teacher like them. I knew nobody when I came to Cyprus, so I didn't have any big circle or a lot of money. So I thought, you know, this is not for me. So I was working extremely hard to convince myself that this is way out of my league. And it's actually my mentors that sort of showed me, you know, why you're not thinking big and you think so small. And so I didn't join PwC with a big plan of becoming a partner or whatever. I just joined PwC as a, looked like a good opportunity at the time and sort of join and see what happens. And 32 years later, I'm still there. So there was a lot of support from my mentors, a lot of support from the firm, and a lot of support from my family and my husband. And the reason I stayed for 32 years and I married a partner and I haven't left and I don't plan to leave and I'm proud to retire there is because I love what I do. And it's very important. I know you have been in the corporate world and you left and the corporate world is not for everybody. And some people, you know, jump off ship. But for me, I found a place that I really loved and actually had three careers within PwC. It's amazing to be able to do different things within the same organization. And it's not the same organization because it evolved over 32 years. The firm I joined back then does not exist anymore. This is a completely different organization now. So a message for people who are listening, you know, in order to be successful in what you do, you need to love what you do. And obviously you love what you do and that's why you're successful. And I love what I do in PwC. And the second message is that nothing comes for free. Opportunities come along, but they all have a cost. There are sacrifices that need to be made to make it to the top. And whatever you do, you give it 100%, unless you give blood, of course. That's what I would say to people. So it was a lot of hard work, determination, a lot of sacrifices made on the way. It's not easy to have a family and make it in a very competitive environment. But, you know, it's doable.
You mentioned the number 32, 32 years at PwC. I also know that there were 32 male partners in the firm, and you were the first female partner in PwC Cyprus. How challenging was it for you to integrate within a male-dominated partner committee or environment? What were the sacrifices that you had to do? What were some of the most awkward, let's say, decisions you had to take so as to come closer or to bring people closer to you and to truly align with the partnership ethos of the times?
Yeah.
Do you have some recollections?
Oh, a lot. Okay, you were right. It was me and 32 men back in 2002. And it was nice and it was difficult at the same time. It was nice to be, you know, the one that got all the attention because you were the different one from the group. And my partners made, you know, whatever they could to make me feel, you know, as part of the group, mm-hmm. even though I was the only one who was a woman there. But no matter what they did, I felt exclusion. I felt that I was the odd one out. I felt that I did not belong in that group. There were jokes about, I don't know, women jokes and blonde ladies. And there was talks about football. I ended up, you know, starting to learn about the matches that took place on the weekend so I could be part of the conversation on Monday morning and laugh at all their jokes, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And what I was doing slowly is integrating with this, what you have said, but adjusting myself and becoming one of them. Mm-hmm. So I was losing my identity in the way I behaved, in the way I dressed, in the way even my humor had changed and my interests were adapted to actually fit into that group. And what that actually taught me is that I'm so much against integration now. And fitting in, I'm more of standing out and having your authentic self and actually be different than anyone else. And that's what actually drove me into inclusion. So in the process of sort of adjusting, it was actually someone who told me that I started behaving and dressing like a man. I didn't even realize it was such a gradual change. And I thought, you know, what a waste of a woman to try and be a man. So from there on, I made a conscious decision to adjust. So I moved from, I don't know, trousers, suits to skirts and dresses and from blue and black to color and scarves, and et cetera, and actually made a point to be different and making it obvious I was different to a point I became a rebel. So now I describe myself as a corporate rebel. I'm the alternative voice in meetings. Mm-hmm. I'm the person who has the craziest, create the craziest atmosphere in a group, who would sort of look for the alternative voices and help other people who are not the same as us to be heard. And that's what actually drove me into inclusion and diversity in PwC. I mean, I can talk for hours about the lessons I learned in the process and whatever, but I just stop here.
So with this experience in mind, what would you have advised the young Cleo who is just embarking on her partnership journey? If you could advise young Cleo with your wisdom now, who was starting as a young partner, what could you advise her now to do or not to do or to avoid or to pursue?
I think it would be not integrating, not trying so hard to integrate, but starting earlier the journey of standing out and making a point that people are different. It would be not to be so hard on myself because I was doing crazy things in my efforts for people to think that I was not on mommy track after I gave birth to my kids and I was still on my career track. So one of the craziest things I did, for example, I gave birth, I can't remember if it was my daughter or one of my sons, but I had a training and I had to go during my maternity leave. Now I would never even advise anybody to sort of break your maternity leave to go on a training. But anyway, because I was thinking, you know, people would think that, you know, I'm not interested in my work anymore, I decided to go to that training. And because I was breastfeeding, I took my baby with me. And my mother-in-law was sitting in the car with the baby. And I was going to the training. And every coffee break, instead of having a coffee, I would go down into the car to breastfeed and back again. In those days, there was no breastfeeding rooms. Mm-hmm. There was nothing enabling, you know, mothers to sort of have their children with them. So going back, I would say, you know, how crazy was that? I mean, why would I need to do that? Why should I go to such a great length of sacrificing even my maternity leave or my baby's well-being just to show that, you know, I'm interested in a training and my career was still on track. So that would be something, looking back, I would say it wasn't necessary, I think.
Do you think that times have changed? So is it more tolerable, or is it more common nowadays for women to feel comfortable in embracing and wearing their feminine roles, whether this entails the motherhood role or the female role in general in the workplace or in general? So is it more possible now to embrace the feminine and the motherhood role without having to invest that extra effort to basically to satisfy whether the male paradigm or the preconception as to how a female partner or employee in general should behave? Is it more, are things more aligned now, more equal, let's say, than in your beginnings?
They're a lot different, and a lot of progress has taken place. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, and thanks to COVID, there was a push into the future because of COVID. So we had like virtual or remote work before COVID, but nobody was choosing that. And after COVID, now everybody is virtual. Now, today I'm here, and after we finish this podcast, I'm going to stay in the hotel and work remotely with my laptop from maybe a veranda or somewhere in the hotel. The same way that a working mom today could decide to stay at home and work from home pretty much every day, if that's what she wishes. So that flexibility, and it's not just flexibility of where you work, on how long you work, and which days you work, and you know, have total flexibility in PwC, is actually making it a lot more easier. A lot easier for women to combine career and motherhood. Having said that, I fully recognize that not everybody is for what I have done. Not everybody wants to sacrifice certain things to make it, either in the corporate world or anywhere they happen to be. So I am pro-choice. So I have full respect for moms who decide to stay at home and take a career path, a career break, and stay with their kids for a few years and come back. That was something I could never do. I don't have the patience to sit at home with the kids all day long. I would go crazy. So that was my choice. So women today have choices. So they can choose to do what I did. They can choose to take a career break. They can choose to whatever they want to do. And employers actually have a duty to allow that choice to take place. Now, what really upsets me is when that choice is forced on women, either because they don't have supporting spouses, partners, or because they don't have a support system, or because they don't have ambition. Like when I started, I didn't have ambition. And they decide to take an alternative route simply because someone told them to do so rather than being their choice. And it's very sad actually to see female talent leave the office because of pressure to be with the family. I think today it's possible to combine the two. You can't be perfect in everything. I mean, you have to let go of perfection. I'm a perfectionist, and that was a very long lesson for me to let go of perfection, because you can't be a perfect mom and a perfect partner and a perfect leader and a perfect wife and a perfect housewife and a perfect cook. So you have to make choices. So I consciously made a choice that I will stop cooking. So I don't cook. I don't enjoy cooking, and it's not my thing. But all my kids enjoy cooking. So now I have three brilliant cooks in the family.
Wow.
Who cook for me. So that's great.
I'm following my train of thought here. And based on what you said, one could argue that, let's go a few decades back on the invention of the pill, okay? That was like a Pandora's box. On the one hand, it led to the liberation of female spirit and female potential. On the other hand, it created a very difficult puzzle for women to solve, One might argue that things are simpler for men. Okay, men are more ambitious driven. They are there is this traditional paradigm as to how a man, as to what a man should aim for. Okay, ambition, success, providing. But for women who have entered the workplace, the puzzle is much more difficult and complex because you have on the one hand the motherhood trajectory for those that wish to embrace it. And on the other hand, you have the career and the ambition trajectory and the interplay between those trajectories is much harder to navigate than people think, which makes me think that it's much harder to be, of course, it's much harder to be a woman in today's modern workplace than a man. Maybe an oversimplification. But I want to pick your brain on that thought of mine.
I think what you're describing is the stereotypical mm-hmm. men and women. And there are a lot of men who are not ambitious, they don't want to be, they're not driven, and they're mm-hmm. more relaxed about what they want to do, and they're more artistic or whatever. I mean, not everybody, but yeah, you're describing the majority. The majority mm-hmm. and the way we're brought up is that men have to be ambitious, they're the breadwinners of the family, they need to make a career, otherwise, you know, they're determined by success and they're actually judged by being successful. Whilst women, you know, I think they had it more easy, you know, if you're at home with your kids, that's what people thought that mm-hmm. what we should do. If you do more than that, then you are like a superhero that you can combine, you know, work and career. But there are women who want to be at home, and there are women who want to make it to the corporate world. Mm-hmm. And there are men who want to be at home. My husband is one of them. So he sacrificed his career so I could have mine. At the age of 40-something, he retired and stayed home with the children. Mm-hmm. And he was doing all the housework and all the driving around of the kids. Mm-hmm. And he's happy. So this is what I said before. It's all choices, and we need to give people choice to do what they really want to do and not actually push them into direction that society wants them to go. So, you know, if you want to be a CEO and you want to conquer the world, and whether you're a man or a woman, you know, you should be able to do that. If you want to have a quiet life and live a village next to the sea and do absolutely nothing and sort of do basic stuff, then yeah, you should be allowed to do that. It doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. But yes, to your question, for women it's a lot more complicated because unfortunately, I mean, talk about Cyprus, we have the lion's share of the housework and the lion's share of taking care of the kids. So we have what we call three shifts. One shift is the work, second shift is the kids, and third shift is the housework. So we do all three. And to be able to combine all that and figure out how to find a balance, because you don't, or how to create a balance, because you don't find balance, you create the balance. It's quite hard.
It's a difficult puzzle.
Yeah. But you need a supporting spouse, partner. It's critical. And I say it to women, before they go into a serious relationship, I'm mentoring a lot of women in the office, that you need to have that serious conversation of sharing of responsibilities, not helping, because the word help is like, it's my responsibility to do the work and you're helping. Sharing the responsibility, all responsibilities in a family is critical. Otherwise, you're going to have that difficult conversation when it becomes impossible. And there we know what happens. The woman will just step down from her career to stay at home, and the man will continue, usually, their career path.
All these points revolve around one of your hats, which is the inclusion and diversity cap. As the PwC Cyprus Chief Inclusion and Diversity Officer, what do you find that it's the most challenging task in your plate? As is there awareness of the importance of inclusion and diversity? Is there understanding of what it means to pursue an inclusive and diverse workplace? Are there prejudices? Big questions. Let's get it from the beginning. So, as the chief inclusion and diversity officer, what are some common misconceptions, let's say, about equality and the pay gap? Let's be specific, not to lose the focus.
Okay.
Big discussion.
There's a difference between equality and equity. Mm-hmm. I always talk about equity because equality, if you treat people, it's all about giving equal opportunities to everybody, mm-hmm. right? So that's what is fair. So give mm-hmm. equal opportunities to everyone. If you treat everybody equally, because not everybody is the same, you mm-hmm. don't give equal opportunity to everybody. And I'll give an example, an obvious one. If you have, say, a blind person in your organization and you have meetings run in exactly the same way and treating that person as the same way as someone mm-hmm. who can see, then that person obviously cannot have equal opportunity. So you need to have different support for people who need different support to be able to have equal opportunity. So that's what equity is all about, to support differently different people so they can mm-hmm. have equal opportunities. Now, equal opportunities don't have equal outcomes. So you give people equal opportunities, and then it's up to them, mm-hmm. you know, how they want to progress. So it's very tough to achieve equity and give everyone the support they actually need. And you can only do that by asking what people need. So that's the first thing. We talk a lot about diversity and inclusion. I think we need to clarify what we mean by that, because there's a lot of misconception mm-hmm. again about what is diversity and what is inclusion. So diversity is the differences that we have. So I'm different from you mm-hmm. and you're different from anyone else. And, you know, there's only one Philippos and there's never been one before and there will never be one mm-hmm. after. So we cannot all be the same. So we're all different. So by definition, we are diverse. Now, when we talk about diversity, we talk about percentage of women in leadership, women in organization, percentage of disabled people in an organization, percentage of, you know, LGBTQ mm-hmm. People in an organization, and these kind of statistics. But it's just measuring how different we are and how many different nationalities, for example, we have in the office, we have 31 nationalities in PwC. Mm-hmm. So that's diversity. Now, inclusion is what's important, because by definition, we're all different and there is diversity to a great extent. Inclusion is actually making all these people feel comfortable to be themselves in an organization that caters for maybe the majority. You need to sort of take care of the minorities as well. So giving different support to different mm-hmm. people, it's quite important to make them thrive, having psychological safety where you can actually say, I made a mistake, or I don't know, or I have a problem and I need support. It's very important for people to be their authentic selves instead of hiding and pretending to be someone else. And it's quite hard. I mean, we talk about these issues as if there's a magic button you press in. It's all about culture, and culture is about behavior. So how do you change behaviors in an organization? It's not an easy thing where you press a button and it happens. It's a gradual process of educating people, giving examples, having role models to talk for these issues. So it's a journey. I started in 2016. It's been now almost 10 years, 8 years. And yeah, there's a long way to go.
One of the main reasons why there are challenges in people feeling included revolves around the human condition and the fear that people who are different from us are not like us. So whether this relates to sex or to ethnicity or to gender or sex orientation, my thinking process is that unless one is able to dispel the fear and the misconception around what it means to be different and from us, it's not possible to break the walls and to bring people together. So this proclivity we have, and in particular some specific personalities have, to feel defensive or to contract when faced with people who are different than them touches on the human condition and on the biases that we all carry, and on the fact that we sometimes identify what is unknown and different with a threat. Do you think that it is, first of all, do you think this is correct? And secondly, is it possible to manage to overcome these primordial biases when it comes to accepting people who are different from us and not seeing them as threats? Is it possible to overcome those biases, whether through trainings or if not, how is it possible to do it?
I think we need to demystify biases. And in trainings I do for biases, I ask the question, who is biased? And some people will put their hand up and some people would not. And the truth is, if you go back to science, we're all biased because, and it's not bad. I mean, it's the only way our brain can cope with a million decisions the brain needs to make every day. So I don't know what this is. I think it's something like 12 million decisions are made unconsciously every second, and you can only process a handful of decisions in a second. So by definition, we're all biased. And we're biased by basically the experiences we have and what we see around us. And if you're in an organization where, I'll just take, for example, the partnership in PwC as an example. Before joining the partnership, it was just 32 men. Mm-hmm. And when you see around you 32 men, what you're looking for is to what is the qualities of the next partner, is the qualities you see in these predominantly alpha males. Mm-hmm. So you're only looking for those qualities. And you wouldn't look for anything else. So to be able to say, okay, we need different types of leaders in an organization, you know, you can't have the same type of leaders, because in today's world where you have serious problems to solve, you need different brains and different way of thinking and diversity of thought and perspectives to be able to solve these complex problems we have today. You can't have groupthink, you can't have people who think the same. But it's human nature to, and it's comfortable to be...
the same.
The same. I mean, take an example. If you walk into a cocktail, say, and you don't know anybody, where do you usually go? You just scan the room and you go where?
The less threatening direction.
Yeah, you go to where people are familiar, more like you, same age, same gender,
that's
and you're more comfortable. It's the same with me. I mean, I walk into a cocktail room, I don't know anybody, I would go to something familiar. Mm. It's nothing wrong with that. It's just human nature. But once you know that you're doing that consciously and that you're biased, that allows you to sort of overcome that and start asking questions and being curious. And it's all about being curious, whether the decision you have made is the right one or whether it's a biased one, whether you have asked input for other people when making the decision. Maybe, you know, my perspective is biased. I should sort of ask a fresh set of eyes and ears to sort of judge whether what I have decided is correct. Because, human nature would go with the familiar, go with, you know, what's similar to us, what's comfortable. You wouldn't. And amazing things happen when you approach people you don't know who are very different. You start asking questions and being curious. And it's amazing how much we have in common with people we think we have nothing in common. We could be here talking for hours and we'll find a million things we have in common.
I suppose that it goes back to the curiosity that you mentioned. So I believe that in order to be able to bring people closer, we need to expand our maps. And how do we expand our maps? By getting to know what it is that we fear. So we see people who are different from us, whether in terms of gender or ethnicity or race or even political belief. How do we ameliorate or we alleviate that fear or that discomfort that we feel when we encounter them? How do we transcend the bias and the wall that the bias brings up for us. We get to know them. And by my experience is that almost always when we get to know some people, we are always surprised because the low resolution image that the mind creates about people we don't know, as you said, it's almost always one that aims to protect us. It's, as you said, the mind takes shortcuts. It follows rules so as to minimize the burden of information. And when we see people who are different than us, most often the default image that is painted is be careful. But once we make the effort to get to know about who the person is opposite to us, then we quickly find out that they are not as different from us as we thought. Everyone wants to be respected, to be valued, to be seen. Everyone has a story. To be listened to. Everyone has a story to tell.
Exactly.
So to break the spell, we have to be curious and to give the opportunity to the other person to show us that they are a person. They are not a monster or a dragon. So the curiosity and perhaps these interventions that you make, the mingling of the people, the opportunity for different people to get to know each other could be in part one of the solutions so as to dispel the fear that is almost by default the setting that we all apply.
I think it's being comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Mm.
So, you know, by walking into a person and asking questions, a very different person from you, yeah, there is fear. But once you overcome that, all you need to do is just ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to show that you know stuff. All you need to do is just ask questions. And then, you know, there's always a story, as you said, with every person. There's something interesting that the person will tell you.
Mm.
You will learn something new for sure. And you find out that you have a lot of things in common. And the same in meetings. You know, I made an effort to ask people who are quiet in meetings, you know, not actually putting them on the spot, but, you know, giving a space so someone who hasn't spoken, you know,
mm-hmm.
wants to share something. And it's amazing people who are quiet because they're either introvert or fear mm-hmm. to talk or not confident enough to talk. Once they open their mouth and you give them the stage, it's just amazing what they say and how many interesting things they have to share. So yeah, it's just overcoming the fear and just asking questions. That's all. It can't be that difficult.
So you replace the fictitious image of the person that you create in your mind with the actuality of the person,
yeah.
Which most likely much more natural and normal and similar to you than the image
yeah.
that you initially create.
The images are usually created because of experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'll give you an example. I was talking to my mother-in-law on Sunday. She came for mm-hmm. lunch and she said, oh, the house has become very unsafe. She lives in the center of Lima. And I said, why is that? I mean, it's just not... Because there's so many people passing by. And I said, yeah, there are always people passing
mm-hmm.
by. Yeah, but they're black ones now.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what does that mean? Oh, I'm so scared of them. And I was like, why? But try and educate an adult, mm-hmm. 80-year-old that, you know, not all black people are dangerous. Yeah, it's very hard work. But because she was groomed and grow up with that image in her head, mm-hmm. immediately when she sees a person like that, it's like fear.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be careful. She wouldn't be going and asking questions. It's not her I'm talking about. But, you know, all these people have a story and they're not.
Absolutely. Yeah. Inclusion and diversity also tap into a different conversation, which has to do with, it often has to do with meritocracy. Some people take the view that inclusion and diversity can go too far. Is this a valid proposition in your experience? So is it possible for DEI initiatives to go too far and to erode meritocratic principles, whether in an organization or a culture? What I mean by that is that if we elevate the principle of, let's say, equality or equity, which are different, as you said, Is it possible that when we do so, we actually undermine meritocracy, whether in terms of recruiting on the basis of race or gender or sexuality, or whether in terms of promotions to leadership positions? Is there such a risk that the DEI initiatives can go too far if not properly and prudently applied?
Are you talking about quotas?
Or the general, the way that we approach and we apply these principles?
Okay, I mean, the principle should be that the best person for the job should be rated, high-performing, or be promoted in the organization. I'm not suggesting that we should promote and remunerate people basically because of their ethnicity, gender, or whatever. Having said that, this, it goes back to what I said before, that our lens in when judging people is very narrow, and is actually as narrow as our experiences. So what are the qualities of a good leader? If you ask, you know, 10 people, you get 10 different answers. So when you're looking, what are you looking for when you say this person should be promoted, or this person's performance was good, or this person's performance was bad? First of all, you need to give people the chance to prove themselves. And I don't think we give equal opportunities to everybody. So it goes back to what I said before. And once you give people the equal opportunities, then, as I said, there's no equal outcome. So if there's no equal outcome, of course you will promote the people who are better performing and better fit for the job. However, when you're looking for, you know, qualities and performance indicators, your lens should be opened up. And I'll give you an example. Making money and bringing clients in, you can have a person who has, you know, all the numbers, brings a lot of clients in, you know, very well trained, technically very competent, but he's a very, he has very bad behavior. So he steps all over people, he sort of creates a place where people don't like to be. And then you have someone else who is, may not be so successful in bringing the revenues, but creates a space of inclusion, caters for, take care of people, looks after their development, their growth, etc. Both qualities are good. But if you're looking just at the numbers, or just at, you know, a specific quality, then you're not, you're actually missing people who may have other qualities that you're not actually valuing so much. So what this, I was against quotas. Up until 10 years ago, I was like, no, women should be promoted because they are of their
meritocracy.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be a token, and all this. And I changed my attitude, because what quotas are doing, or targets, let's not talk about quotas, targets, it's, you know, you can meet them or not meet them. Quotas is, I have to sort of have this number of women or whatever. What they're doing is basically forcing you to open that lens and see other people in the pipeline who may be overlooked because you are looking simply at specific things. So that's what targets are doing. And all the countries that have actually had big progression in I'll just say women in leadership is because they put targets. Without targets, like any business, you have a business target, you have a revenue target, you have all sorts of targets. This should also be a target, which you may meet, you may not meet, but you're forced to actually address it. If you're not forced to address it, then biases will kick in, and automatically the progress of women in leadership is about 1% per year. And it's going to take another 40, 50 years to get to 50%.
So the idea is that the proper application of these rules is to open the lens and to widen the net of the candidates that you are assessing, whether for a recruitment or promotion or appraisal, and that's the idea. And a misapprehension of this idea, which is often in the public debate nowadays with the culture wars, as they are called, is that the quotas are basically a totalitarian way of equalizing the workplace, especially on top levels, and of making the diversity and inclusion priorities, but placing those priorities on top of meritocracy and other values. So perhaps this is why this conversation is becoming so polarized.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, we have people who say you are elevating, not you, I mean the paradigm. So when we elevate the DEI values on top of everything else, we are basically eroding the foundations of meritocracy, which then we lead to resentment brooding in the workplace between people who feel that they are being treated unjustly, and because it creates a special class of people who are only placed in certain positions because of their sex or gender or other minority identity situation. Do you think this is a valid discussion that is happening on the public sphere as a tug of war, or is it a fictitious one?
I think with all things, it shouldn't be taken to extremes. And if you take things to extremes, then you're basically polarizing. You're pushing people to go exactly the opposite way. That's what's happening now in the world.
It's politicized as well.
Yeah, yeah. And in the same way that we talk about the oppression by the majority, mm-hmm. to whatever extent that exists, there's also now what people call the tyranny of the minority. We got to a point where you have the minority actually oppressing the majority. Mm-hmm. It's a very long discussion. It's a very controversial discussion to enter into in this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
What I will say is that my stand is that nobody should be going into violence, whether this is physical violence or verbal violence,
mm-hmm.
To discredit or, I don't know, attack people that don't agree with him or her.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's not something that I can accept. And a lot of these people are now going into aggressive behaviors and violent behaviors. And that's not how you make progress in the mm-hmm. world. I think the more you become over the top, let's just say, the more people become polarized and go the other way. So all this that is going on in the world is actually damaging the work that people like me are doing, because when you talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, everybody thinks about that agenda and not really what we're talking about here.
Okay, let's move to the learning and development, because that's a conversation that cannot be exhausted.
Oh,
we need another podcast just to tap onto it. So as a learning and development officer, that's another cap that you have, which partly manifests in interventions on diversity and inclusion, but not only. What strategies do you employ to develop talent within PwC? Do you have any overriding strategies to develop talent?
Oh, to start with, we have an academy. It's called the PwC Academy.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually responsible for all the learning and growth of our people. And not just our people, also our clients. We, mm-hmm. through that academy, we're also doing trainings for clients, whether these are bespoke trainings or general open seminars where people can come. So in the academy, we have three types of upskilling, as we call it. You have the technical skills, whether this is accounting, tax, VAT, or whatever. You have digital skills, which is anything to have to do with technology, which is increasingly important. And you have what I call human skills, which is what they call soft skills.
Mm-hmm.
And people go through various learnings every year. Technical are compulsory for people. Mm-hmm. Most of the trainings we do. So you have to attend because you need to be technically competent to do your work. There are technical trainings which are voluntary, and then you have digital and human, which are voluntary, and people just choose and what they want to do. What we have done in the last couple of years was to develop what we call a learning catalog. So we did an a la carte menu of learnings, so people can go and choose and book themselves into different types of learnings, and we have trainers internal and also external speakers will come to us and speak to people. about all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's becoming hugely popular going forward. So technical capabilities, yes, you need to have, but from some point on, in order to progress and become a leader, you need the human skills. And that's what we are increasingly focusing on in the academy. So there's a curriculum for everybody that they need to attend. It's up to, as I said, certain things are compulsory, but the rest is up to each individual to take his or her personal growth in his or her hands.
Do you find any patterns of interest? Do people have a specific, let's say, interest nowadays for specific topics out of the non-compulsory ones? Is there a trend as to what people are keen on learning? Or
what we do, we ask at the end of each training, you know, what else would you like to? And there's some suggestions that come through, but most of the curriculum is set by us, by taking into account. So we have trainings like curiosity is a training.
Really?
Being curious is a training. Storytelling in business is a training. Negotiation is a training. Leading with inclusive behaviors is a training. So we have all these types of trainings that how to make, I don't know, impactful presentations, both in content and in delivery. All these are all soft skills trainings that we do.
I suppose you don't teach choreography.
But not in PwC.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Coming back to choreography now, do you see any common themes in the world of choreography and leadership?
How much time do we have?
We have a few minutes.
Okay.
The
first thing that I was taught from dancing is discipline.
Okay.
And dancing is like any type of athletics. I mean, you could have an athlete that you tell you that I train, you know, a specific training because I need, whether you are running a marathon or whether you are competing in the Olympics, it's a training. And the same with dancing, you need to have discipline. And we have what I called in the corporate world, the corporate athletes. So it's exactly the same. So you try every day to be a better version of yourself and you perform better, whether you're dancing, running, or doing technical work. So you are in competition with yourself. Taking care of yourself is important in performance, whether you are dancing, running, or being in the corporate world. There's a lot of teamwork involved in that you learn when you dance, because it's not a solo sport. It's something that you do with a partner or with other groups of people. There's a lot of creativity and there's a lot of value in creativity. And it's amazing, you know, how you can express yourself through dancing. And you could do the same in the corporate world. So sort of training yourself to be creative actually helps in the work as well. And actually combine dancing and work, even in trainings or even in conferences. I do that. So
you dance at conferences?
Yeah.
Wow.
So there's a lot of, you just need to be creative to combine. There's a lot of similarities between the two.
To what extent is, let's say, choreography scripted versus free? So you have the script or you have the choreography, and then I suppose there is a space within which you are allowed to be creatively free.
Yeah.
Can you quantify it? Is it like 80-20, 90 choreographed, 10 free? Is it 50-50? Is there such a formula, roughly speaking?
It depends on you, on how creative you want to be. So what I do, I'm a Zumba instructor. So I moved away from classical dancing into Latin, bachata, kizomba, salsa, and now I became a Zumba instructor. And I do that every day.
So every day?
I have three groups, one in Lima, one in Nicosia, and one in Maroni, where I live. And I do that every day. So in Zumba, you have choreographies that come ready. Every couple of months, there's a new set that comes, and you can learn that and
teach
that.
It's like a script.
Yeah, it's like a script.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can just take a song and do your own choreography. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of both. If I feel right, you know, I need to create and I need to, I love a song, or there are students who come and say, you know, can we do this song? And they give it to me. And then I sit over the weekend and do a choreography. And I usually do that while I'm ironing. So it's a very, it's a boring thing that doesn't need to think, and actually put music on, and that's where I...
So you are ironing the details of the dance.
Yeah, something like that. So it's a mixture of getting ready choreos. If I come, I don't have the time, I will just do that. But if I feel like, okay, let's do this song, I will do that.
I find that it's the same with the workplace. So you need a degree of rules and process, I would say, and script or procedures, and the tried and tested way of doing things. But you also need to be able to improvise and to breathe, because too much rigidity will lead to stagnation. You get bored, or your spirit dies. But if it's only improvisation, it's only creativity and no rules, no structure, no nothing, then
it's chaos. Exactly.
So I think there has to be an interplay,
a right balance
between the improvisation and the structure. So coming back to the beginning, we talked about the way that you masterfully balance dance, dancing, choreography, and a very admirable career. To close this podcast, I would like to ask you the things that I always ask. Firstly, I would like to ask you, what is the best piece of advice you ever received?
Best piece of advice I ever received.
You remember from a mentor? Or
I think it would be from my daughter, actually. My daughter is one of my mentors.
Okay.
Yeah. And she was wearing a T-shirt, and I totally relate to what we're saying. She was saying, the teacher was saying, and then we had to talk about it, I better be someone's special shot of whiskey than everyone's cup of tea. And that goes back to authenticity,
yes, of
being yourself. And you can't be liked by all, and it's not likability you'll be seeking, but being your true self. So that's, and that's what I advise a lot of people to do.
So to be brave enough to be themselves.
To be yourself. And stand out, even if you don't fit in, they're different than anyone else. The same way I was one in 32 men, and I was different. Be brave to stand out and not to integrate and try to sort of become.
That's marvelous. And what is the worst piece of advice you ever received, if you can remember?
Worst piece of advice. I think it would be from my parents.
Okay.
For them wanting me to become a teacher, so I could have, you know, Christmas and Easter and summers off to look after my kids. I don't blame them for that, because that's what they knew at the time. And they thought that was the best for me, and they kept saying that even after I became a partner. And only after they realized how happy I was with what I was doing. But if I follow that advice, I would be a very miserable teacher now.
But in part, you became a teacher because you are the head of learning and development.
Yeah.
In part.
But that's teaching adults. It's a different
thing. And teaching Zumba as well.
And teaching Zumba. Again, adults, yeah.
And finally, can you share with us three books, if you can recall, on personal development or leadership that have helped you become who you are today? Do you have any favorite books?
I'm not a book reader, Felipe. So
podcasts?
We're discussing, you know, in the morning I love podcasts. And there's a lot of value in podcasts. Mm-hmm. And because I do a lot of traveling every day, I sort of use that hour, two, three in the car to listen to podcasts. That's what I do. I don't have a lot of time reading books, unfortunately, so I can't give you three. I've read quite a few, but nothing that I can, that stands out.
Any final pieces of advice to the people listening to this podcast who are thinking about, let's say, whether taking a big step in their career or combining motherhood with their ambition, or anything that maybe emerge from this conversation that you would like to relate to the audience, like advice or suggestions?
I don't think I'm qualified to give advice. I just can share only experiences and what I can say, because there's a lot of talk about work-life balance these days and mental health and all this stuff. And what I say to people is that you create your balance, you cannot find it. So it's not work-life balance, it's work-life integration, as I call it. So it's a matter of finding what works for you. And, you know, something has to give, you can't do everything. But it's a matter of deciding what sacrifices you make from both sides to make this work. And what I do, I mean, most people say, you know, I don't have time to come to class, to Zumba class, because I'm too busy and I'm working. And I said, do I look like I'm sort of don't have work to do? Of course, we're all busy. But it's the time where you shut your laptop, you go and do some exercise, you clear your mind, and you can go back and open your laptop. I mean, you have that flexibility in the office. So like everything in life, when things don't work and you shut down and restart, it's the same with human beings. You just shut down and restart. And 1 hour doing, I don't know, walking nature or exercising or whatever, it's an hour you have to make to be able to clear your mind and perform better at what you do.
Cleo, thank you very much for coming.
It's a pleasure.
For sharing your wisdom and your experiences. And I would like to wish you to continue doing what you love and to giving the good example to the people around you and to everyone that you meet.
Thank you, Philippe. Same to you. And you're doing great work too. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Is this another game of my mind? I'm wide awake. I hear my name. I turn around. There's no one again. I won't forget the day she left. Slammed the door and never